Now, this wasn't a trade where caravans marched in large numbers. A great deal of this trade was by exchange from one community to another. But something is beginning to happen here at the beginning of the 4th millennium BC. Because the trade isn't just between one city-state and another, over, say, a distance of 100 miles. You're now seeing much, much longer distance connections developing. Connections which linked Southwest Asia and Mesopotamia with eastern Iran, even with the Indus Valley in Pakistan. So the Indus Valley was linked to Mesopotamia, Mesopotamia to Anatolia, modern-day Turkey, those areas eventually to the Nile and the Mediterranean coast. You were developing a much, much larger lattice of interaction. Or, as some people call it, the world's first world economic system, or first global economy. This is a bit overdrawn, but for the first time, you're finding human societies trading on a very much larger scale, where they're really dealing with civilizations like themselves, with individual rulers or whatever, at much longer distances. There is no question, too, that this much larger connection is connected also with the improvement of long-distance transportation. Sailing boats developed on the Nile and in Mesopotamia. Wheeled carts came in very rapidly. Draft oxen. Donkeys used for caravans. In other words, people were moving off the tyranny of the limited load carried on people's shoulders, which was always a problem, say, for the Maya and the Aztecs, who did not have draft animals. And from this developed not just Sumerian civilization, but a much larger Eastern Mediterranean world. Sumerian civilization itself was born of the growing interdependence of city-states in Mesopotamia. Each of them was small. They competed, they fought, they traded with each other in a very, very volatile political and diplomatic environment where there was constant negotiation, an intricate pattern of ever-changing alliances that came into being and evaporated and came back generation to generation, city to city, ruler to ruler. The point you must understand, however, which I emphasize again and again, is that Mesopotamia was not unique. For cities were also developing in other parts of Southwest Asia, as far afield as the Indus Valley in Pakistan and on the Iranian plateau. This volume of long-distance trade which resulted in much larger political ambitions. The trade increased, much of it carried by donkey caravans and by ships. And inevitably, as society became more complex, so city rulers became more secular and the priesthood a specialized occupation. They may still be divine kings, but their primary concerns were secular. Particularly in the world of Sumeria, where civilization was a world of constant bickering and shifting alliances. Some city-states, like Ur, famous for the excavations by the British archaeologists Leonard Woolley before World War II, had periods of great political strength and prosperity when they dominated their neighbors. And then, just as swiftly, perhaps the result of a reign by a couple of less competent rulers and ambitious neighbors, they would tumble into obscurity and become vassals of a neighbor. There was no permanent political unity. No vast state like you find in Egypt. It was constant warfare waged by the world's first standing armies. This was not informal warfare. This was institutionalized warfare because standing armies were one of the keys to maintaining political power. This was a patchwork, quarrelsome, volatile, but with enormous potential. Some Sumerian cities nurtured powerful rulers, like the wealthy individuals buried in the famous royal burials at the ancient city of Ur excavated by British archaeologist Leonard Woolley, as I told you, in the 1930s. He reconstructed a funeral where the mourners had dug a deep funerary pit, buried the body of a prince in a stone burial chamber at the foot of it, surrounded by his faithful retainers, who were sacrificed to accompany him in death, in all his glorious golden regalia. And then